I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to James S. Fishkin, Janet M. Peck Chair in International Communication at Stanford University, where he is Professor of Communication, Professor of Political Science, and the Director of the Center for Deliberative Democracy. We're discussing his 2018 book, Democracy When the People Are Thinking, Revitalizing Our Politics Through Public Deliberation. Fishkin works on democratic theory, particularly deliberative democracy, and is best known for developing the deliberative poll. He is the author of When the People Speak, Deliberation Day, Democracy and Deliberation, as well as many other books and articles. So let me say, first of all, Jim Fishkin, thanks so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
It's my pleasure.
So Jim, this is a great book. I loved this book, along, been following your work for years. This book in particular combines a really persuasive theoretical defense of deliberative democracy with a lot of empirical support for deliberative democracy's success, which is something new and a lot of cutting-edge research on this, so I appreciated that. Can I start by asking you first about the motivation for writing the book?
Sure. I think that democracy is under threat. Liberal democratic values are at risk. Our model of competitive democracy, which is the primary model for democracy around the world, is not delivering the goods, and it's facing a kind of legitimacy crisis. The approval ratings for democratic institutions in almost every country that has them are vanishingly low, there's hyper-partisanship and a kind of conflict between, a pitched conflict between policy elites who are distrusted and the mass public whose voice has been taken over to some degree by the angry voices of populism. And so the model that we're using doesn't work, and I think it needs some reform, not wholesale replacement, but some reform. And I think the way to reform it is to bring the voice of the people in a representative and thoughtful way. Part of the problem would be worse if critics of or supporters of competitive democracy who tell us we can't do any better, like Aiken and Bartels in Democracy for Realists, who think the public is just incompetent to make decisions. If they were right, that would be, I would be after a different solution. But in fact, my work and that of others doing deliberative democracy work makes it pretty clear that the public is competent if you approach them in the right way. It's as if we have the wrong operating system that we're trying to reach the public with, you know, maybe one of those old MS-DOS systems, which were impossible. But it's not that the public is incompetent, it's that our institutions are not enabling, and we need to enable the public voice. And why is that important? It's because from a normative theory standpoint, the whole point of democracy is to make some connection, in my view, between the will of the people and what's actually done. Who's elected or what policies are adopted, some connection between the public will and what happens. And we have a number of factors, and some of them are exacerbated by competitive democracy and the incentives therein, factors that strangle the public will or distort it beyond recognition. Those factors are that, and they fuel the hyper-partisanship that we've been seeing. Political parties don't want to win the argument, they want to win the election. And if they can distort or manipulate public opinion in order to do so successfully, they will do that. Schumpeter, who is the preeminent theorist of competitive democracy, said way back in his Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy that we should expect a synthetic public will, one that is manufactured by political parties in the same way that firms will manufacture the preferences to support their products in the marketplace, basically propaganda, or advertising, if you want to say it more nicely. But the advertising need not be accurate. The propaganda could be entirely misleading or made up out of whole cloth. So basically, there are incentives to manipulate the public, but also the basic structure of the relation between the citizen and the polity in mass society is that the citizens have an incentive not to become informed, but to they have an incentive to be rationally ignorant, as Anthony Downs showed back in 1957. If I have one vote in millions, why should I pay a lot of attention? My individual vote or opinion won't make much difference. And secondly, a second factor that inhibits public will formation is that social media have put us all in, or many of us in, filter bubbles. And the algorithms will tend to keep us there by giving us information that we find congenial and never exposing us to the other side of the argument. So the whole liberal democratic project, which you see in, let's say, John Stuart Mill, who rationalized the, who justified liberty of freedom thought and expression, and along the way he argued that the cure for objectionable speech was more speech, and people would be, liberty would allow people to be exposed to diversity. With diversity, they would consider competing arguments, and they would think for themselves and achieve what Mill called individuality. We may be thinking for ourselves, but our own liberty and then the choices we make with it impair the extent to which we can really think for ourselves, because we may never hear the other side. We're likely not to hear the other side. We tune into our favorite cable channels, our favorite news blogs, our favorite talk radio, et cetera, et cetera. We're not going to have a good sense of what the other side of the argument or what the competing sides of the argument are. So we're handicapped in that. And so my thought is to use deliberative democratic methods, and I've spent a lot of time over the years developing one, but I don't say the one that I've been engaged in, which I call deliberative polling, is the only possible one or the best possible one. I'm sure that as technology develops and as creative minds turn to the issue, there will be other methods that very successfully accomplish the same thing. And what is that? What we want to answer with deliberative polling and these deliberative microcosms or mini publics more broadly, in my view, is to answer the question, a very simple question, a question that is misleadingly simple. It is, what would the people think under good conditions for thinking about an issue? So a lot depends on how you get the people and how you get the good conditions. My answer to how you get the people is random sampling, stratified random sampling, and good stratified random sampling, where it's sufficiently transparent so that we know what kind of microcosm we have both in demographics and in the attitudes of the people, so that the group that gathers together is a little bit like what Mill describes in representative government in the passages where he talks about the Congress of Opinions, a kind of ideal parliament, where each person in the society should be able to see his or her viewpoint, he doesn't say or her, but his viewpoint expressed as well or better than he could express it in the Congress of Opinions, and answered by others who have different viewpoints as well or better than they could answer them, and then that the conclusions that the Congress of Opinions would come to would be not by a mere act of will, but on the basis of the best arguments available. It's very Habermasian. It sounds very much like what Habermas calls the unforced force of the better argument, which he, as I argue in my book, does not, in fact, self-consciously eschews an institutional specification of how to do that. Mm-hmm. But I think, as a practical matter, we have to try to do that, and the deliberative poll is my effort to do so, because unless we can actually get the considered judgments that represent the public and insert them with appropriate entry points into the political process, the policy process, we will not be able to improve democracy, or we will not be able to add this magic ingredient of the will of the people. I mean, the will of the people is invoked all the time. Anytime anybody wins an election, they say it's the will of the people.
Right.
Even if they've, you know, even if they've lied and misled, and I'm sure that Boris Johnson, after the Brexit buses with the wrongly stated that there were, you know, the healthcare system would get £350 million a week if they left the EU. I'm sure that he said that was, and has said many times, that it was the will of the people.
Hmm.
But of course, there was no stack of money to give the £350 million a week because Mrs. Thatcher had negotiated a rebate. So it was just wrong on that. But that was a consequential case.
Yeah. Can I just add?
The point is that you need the will of the people, and you need a practical method to get it. And so my book engages both the political theory arguments, going back to the Athenians and to the American founding and Madison, and it also engages the empirical issues about how you get it. The political theory arguments are about why you need it, why democracy without an appropriate apparatus of public will formation is open to capture by intense interests, nefarious interests, interests that want to impersonate the public and take over. So those are the motivations of the book. And I would add one more thing, that broadly speaking, I think democracy is under threat, not only because people are losing faith in it, but also because it has competition. And I think the most dangerous competition is not the brute authoritarianism, but it's what Mill would have called benign dictatorship or benign authoritarianism. That is, if you had it's sort of Singapore. Singapore has very good technocrats who make very good policy without any reference to, without a recognizable democratic process, and without the, they do cost benefit analysis and they try to serve the public interest, but they are not responsive to the public will. So, there are two unfortunate futures facing democracy. One is benign authoritarianism, and the other might be a kind of crude populism, which then leads to what some people are calling competitive authoritarianism. That is, the democratic processes on the surface, but not in a way that actually engages actual competitive processes. And the reason that we need deliberative processes is that merely ensuring competition is not enough, because competition brings out the hyperpartisanship, the mutual vilification, the scapegoating. Competition actually incentivizes some of the worst behavior. Mm-hmm. We need competition, but competition without deliberation is not going to lead to any meaningful public will formation. It's going to lead to a pox on both your houses. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's an overview of the motivations.
Yeah, that's great. I wanted to dig in a little bit into the theoretical side, and I thought maybe you've been developing a defense of deliberative democracy, and a lot of other people have over the past 20 years, so I don't want to retrod a lot of already tread ground. But one of the things that you do quite well, I think, in the first part is take on a couple of the criticisms of democracy, which you already mentioned the Aiken and Bartels book. And I thought maybe you could say a little bit more about your response to them. I mean, the Aiken and Bartels, this is probably well known by now, in their book, Democracy for Realists, challenges the notion of, or challenges the idea of a kind of robust notion of democracy, or the formation of a public will on the basis of political science evidence, really, that purports to demonstrate that the many individuals in the public have incoherent views about politics, and that they don't tend not to vote based on the common good, but tend to vote based on their particular identity or their interests. And so that leads them to embrace, as you point out, the Schumpeterian competitive view of democracy. So maybe say a little bit more about your response to them. How is it, where do they go wrong?
Well, I don't think they go wrong in their criticisms. I mean, I'm not sure if they really have my colleague Mo Fiorina write about the retrospective voting, because they seem to base the argument very largely on this case about the shark attacks in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. But suppose you say, well, Downsian spatial modeling doesn't really work to express the public will. Retrospective voting doesn't really work to express the public will. There are the real problems with referendums and initiatives and direct democracy, and the heuristics don't really approximate, you know, more informed preferences very well. And so they basically are doing a wrecking ball action against the devices that political scientists have developed over the years to reassure themselves that the public is really thoughtfully engaged in government. And I think they're right about that. But that doesn't mean that they couldn't be. That doesn't mean that it means that we need to think about the reform of institutions. Mm-hmm. And I think they spend about a paragraph on my deliberative polling initiative and sort of dismiss it without, you know, saying very much about it. But I think that democracy is in such a state that we need a lot of experimentation, not just mine, and we need a lot of innovation, not just mine. And rather than giving up on the people, because the one thing I've learned from, we've now done 108 deliberative polling projects around the world in 28 countries, the one thing I've learned is that given the chance, the public is pretty smart. And that people can deal with complex reasons and competing value trade-offs if you make them easily accessible and they see the basic choices. And of course, many people are always trying to confuse them with technical arguments and asides or, you know, reality show come-ons. But in fact, if you engage them in the substance and they see what's really at issue, they will make thoughtful choices and they'll offer reasons. They may not be the choices that I personally would make, but that doesn't matter. So that's why our projects always have, you know, are always balanced, and we try to get the best information we can. We vet them with experts from different points of view. And so we try to get the people engaged to really think about the issues. And even in places where the public is not literate, they're able to deal. So we've done projects as described in the book, two projects in Uganda, but also there's a recent article that we've published about the project in Ghana, and we've done them in Senegal and Malawi and Tanzania. Very poor countries, and in some places, areas where the public was mostly not literate. And you might say, how could they deliberate then? Well, with our university partners in Africa, we create video versions of the briefing materials so they don't have to read anything. Hmm. We interview them orally so they don't have to fill out any questionnaires. And we have otherwise the same process, and we've taped all the small groups and for transcripts of the discussions, which we've translated back from local dialect into English. And associate director Alice Sue at the center has been analyzing transcripts with automated text analysis for the reasoning and finds it at a very high level. And recent PhD student, Kai-Ping Chen, has an article where she analyzes the level of justification as with the Discourse Quality Index in California and in Ghana, and finds that the Ghanaians in the northern city of Tamale, which is very poor, and where many of the respondents have little or no education, the level of reasoning is quite comparable to the reasoning in California in terms of whether they offer arguments rather than just assert preferences, whether they answer those arguments with other arguments, coding the discussion. So the people, even in rather dire circumstances, are capable. Mm-hmm. And they're certainly capable in the more developed countries. So all over the world, this kind of work can be done, I think, except maybe under conditions of conflict where it might be dangerous to get people together. Mm-hmm. But then there might even be the possibility of doing it online. And as you know from the book, we've been doing projects online with video, mm-hmm. some with Zoom now, which you and I are using now to talk to each other, mm-hmm. with Zoom or other technologies where you can see and talk to everybody in your small group, and then you can also have the plenary sessions in Zoom, and you can do the whole thing. We just did a version of this in the UK on Brexit issues, where we did a two-day deliberative poll on Zoom, almost everybody who started the first day, you know, came back the second day, and so we would help confirm the idea that because you see everybody in your group, you bond, and it's just like the face-to-face, but we save all the money for the travel and transportation, mm-hmm. to bring people from all over the country to a single place. Mm-hmm. So this is, I think, a good specimen of the future. Mm-hmm. And we can make those a controlled experiment. Mm-hmm. So we see that it's really deliberations that are causing the change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really impressive. I mean, the book you have conducted these deliberative polls in 27 countries on six continents, and it's quite impressive. You talk in detail about cases in California, in Europe, but also in places like Mongolia and Uganda. I thought maybe you could maybe pick one of those cases that you particularly liked or found robust outcomes from, and maybe give us a sense of what the deliberative poll was about and what the outcome was?
Well, in California, the state was in crisis, and there were a lot of reforms. It was a very ambitious project about the legislature, the initiative system, the state-local relations, which are always complicated because of the Proposition 13 and the tax change. So the state has to provide some money that local taxes usually provide in other states. And then the tax and spend issues. And so they're very and a couple of things stood out for me. One was at the time we did the project, the approval rating of the legislature was, I think, something like 9% or 10%. The LA Times at the time did a poll, which was similar to a poll that we did on a policy option, which was have a part-time legislature with part-time pay, which a lot of people on the right have been advocating. And I think the LA Times poll was that something like 65% of the state wanted that. And in any case, when we included that among the policy options and the people talked about that as a political reform, there was strong support for it on first contact. But then they started talking about what would happen if you only paid the legislators half their salary, and they'd have to find the other half someplace else, and it might open things to corruption and influence. And we did regressions with the values about corruption and other things, and sure enough, that was definitely one of the causal levers, because support at the end of the day went way down. I can't remember exactly, but you know, something like 25% at the end of the day. It just collapsed. There was another very striking result, and this was even more surprising and too striking for too outside the political mainstream for us to act on it or figure out how to act on it in any easy way. But this was a time when, you know, there's so much dissatisfaction with the legislature that there was interest in there certainly was great support for term limits. There was a proposal to increase the terms. It's not the same as term limits, which applies to the number of terms, but still much in the same spirit. Increase the length of terms. That is, in the state assembly, increase them from 2 years to 4 years, in the state senate from 4 years to 6 years. In other words, give the politicians more time. Percentages supporting that, we had three waves at home on arrival at the end, went up just dramatically. It was something like, you can look it up online or in the book, but you know, it's something like 25% to 84% by the end, which is not just an earthquake. I mean, it's a big earthquake in public opinion. It's a gigantic change of opinion. Why? Because the people said, these legislators are spending all their time raising money. They don't have time to legislate. Maybe if we gave them more time, they would be able to do their job. And just as also on the other proposal about the legislature, which was to cut back the part-time legislature with part-time pay, one person on the broadcast, which you see in one of the small groups, and you can see the broadcast on our website, one person on the broadcast said, yeah, let them get a real job, you know, let them go work in their community. But the trouble is, what kind of a job is a legislator going to be able to get in the community? One that might pose, you know, conflicts of interest and problems. Mm-hmm. So that was the problem. So now in a much more routine way, we also did a number of things on the initiative system, including some very commonsensical reforms about having, at the time, if once an initiative, you know, was approved, you couldn't change it. It was sort of like a contract between the proponents of the initiative who gathered the signatures and the rest. And so you couldn't change it, even if you discovered flaws. So there was openness to being able to modify an initiative with the approval of the proponents. And then there was very strong support for making it easy to find out who was funding the campaigns for and against any given initiative. Mm-hmm. Technically, that information was available, but through an impossible website where it was just, you couldn't, you have to be very clever to be able to get to it. And so it was not effectively available. And so those reforms were actually adopted by the legislature in an initiative reform. So that was good. Now, the basic idea that we had when we did that California project was not a success, however, but it certainly was a noble idea, I think, which was that the people in microcosm, that is, in a deliberation, should be able to formulate an initiative that would go on the ballot. But of course, the problem is the signature collecting is so expensive, it costs millions of dollars to get something on the ballot. So we actually did put something on the ballot, but it was in order to get a coalition that could fund it, various well-meaning interest groups, civic groups, added lots of things, sort of loaded it up with other things that attracted opposition. So we show in the article that if the initiative had just had the stuff that the people approved in the deliberative poll, in terms of polling that we did at the time of the election, it arguably could have passed. But because of the additional things that led to opposition, it didn't. So that was a kind of mixed adventure. The other thing I would say about a case in the book is the Ugandan cases in the Mount Elgon region, Bududa and Buteleja, were very interesting. And what one of the things that stands out to me is this is an area where that's subject to recurrent disasters, floods and rock slides. And the floods and the rock slides had destroyed the elementary schools, and they had destroyed the local health care clinics. They called them health center twos. And so when we had our results, we presented them at dissemination meetings, including the governors of the two regions and districts. And they had been very proud that they had rebuilt the schools and the healthcare clinics, but they had built them with much bigger schools and much bigger healthcare clinics with new technology, much more expensive and much, much farther away. And what they didn't realize in listening to the, they hadn't listened to the people, and they didn't know that the schools were so far away that the families stopped sending the girls to school because they were afraid they'd be molested walking, you know, an hour or 2 hours to get to elementary school. And so they just kept them at home. So the new pattern was the girls weren't getting any education at all. And this is an area that's greatly overpopulated. And they were just making progress in family planning, which the government supports family planning. But when these disasters came along, and the women said there's no way that they were going to, there were lots of apprehensions about whether family planning was safe. And there's no way that, you know, if they had to walk to a healthcare clinic 2 hours each way, that they were going to go to these new clinics for family planning. So the family planning stopped. So in other words, the very laudable initiative to replace and rebuild after the disaster had led to results that were, in an unanticipated way, very bad for women and very bad for girls. And so the district governors, when they heard this, immediately understood, because we had lots of data. We also showed how the opinions changed so that they would support. They wanted them to build elementary schools right in the villages. They wanted them to rebuild the health center twos right near the villages. And my understanding is that that is what is now happening. So that's an example. I mean, it doesn't take a lot of sophisticated philosophical reasoning to understand, but that's an understanding of how you need to consult the people who have to live with the policies. And even from, you know, a technocratic perspective, if you look at the whole district, it might seem really good to build these new things that are far away. Unless you listen to the people, you wouldn't know what the actual consequences were. Mm-hmm. So that and some other things are in the Uganda article, because there were two of them there. So those are some of the cases that are in the book. But there are others. That are mentioned more briefly. The series of projects in Texas that mm-hmm. what took Texas from being last to being first among the 50 states in the amount of wind power, or mm-hmm. How we catalyzed the desegregation of the Roma-only schools. And of course, in Mongolia, one of the really exciting things is that the success at the city level in Ulaanbaatar led the government to adopt a law on deliberative polling that requires deliberative polling for constitutional amendments. And we did a big national project there that's described in the book, and the legislature is considering the result. Yeah. So that's a form of institutionalization that we haven't achieved before. And that feeds right into my discussion in the latter part of the book of what's called deliberative systems. Mm-hmm. That is how you can create a system where deliberation enters at certain points in the process and may have a role in effective governance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to, before we get to the third part, just a question about the second part, which we're discussing on the empirical cases. One of the other interesting bits that you do in this section is you take on some of the empirical objections, as it were, to deliberative democracy, which come from different quarters, but at least one of the objections goes like this, that, well, the problem with deliberative democracy is that in deliberations, the dominant groups often are the ones that are most vocal, and they're the ones whose voices carry the day. And the other objection, which comes mainly from Cass Sunstein, is the notion of polarization, that in polarization here with a particular technical way of thinking about it, that in a way in juries, typically the first mover is the one who sets the agenda, as it were. And so the jury polarizes from based on that first mover. And you don't find any empirical evidence for both of these objections. In fact, you find the opposite. And I was curious what your thoughts were about why it is that, I mean, because you might expect that both of those objections would hold. Why do you expect that, or why do you think that they don't?
Well, it does seem that they should, and a lot of critics and friends of mine who are theorists have just asserted that this must happen.
Right. This is the truth. Yeah, right. Yeah.
And so this is a kind of armchair theorizing.
Right.
And our view, and I'm part of a collaborative network that studies these things, but our view is that it depends on the design.
Yeah.
And so the closer things are to the jury, and the jury, as I argue, and Bruce Ackerman and I argued in Deliberation Day, the jury does fairly well, but it does have these predictable defects. So we think that, well, first of all, on the polarization, Cass thinks it's the imbalance in the argument pool and the social comparison effect that produce the movement to more extreme positions. Now, if you have a system that is balanced, where people are encouraged to consider a broad variety of arguments on either side, and you have a mechanism that facilitates that, you can overcome the imbalance in the argument pool. And then if you have a process whereby you only offer your final considered judgment in confidential questionnaires or secret ballots, and you train the moderators so that you're not encouraging the people to take votes or shows of hand or so that everybody knows the distribution of opinion, you also encourage people as a matter of to take the devil's argument, make the devil's argument, or to consider the other side, so that you know you don't really know how people are going to come out. Then you can avoid those two mechanisms, which are the primary mechanisms that he thinks are at issue. In any case, with both Alice Hsu's work and my colleague Bob Luskin and Gaurav Sood and Q Han, we've looked at thousands of small group issue combinations. That is, on a given issue, we look at how the group moves, and do they move, is there a consistent pattern of moving away from the middle, which is what Sunstein calls polarization, moving to a more extreme position, or not? And there's no consistent pattern half the time. If you look at all these thousands of small group issue combinations, half the time they move away and half the time they move towards the middle. So there's no pattern at all. Secondly, we look at domination by the more advantaged, that is domination by the rich, the highly educated, the males, if there's a favored racial group. And you look at their initial positions and you see if there's movement. If these people were going to impose their views on everybody else, there should be movement in their direction. And we find no such pattern either. It's about 50% also, with thousands of small group issue combinations. So we think the reason for that is you have a moderated discussion where everybody's voice counts. Nobody gets to talk too much. Indeed, Alice Hsu has discovered that the talking time is pretty equal, even between men and women, and in terms of the number of minutes, the number of words. But it's not just the talking time, it's the influence on the change, whether the direction of change goes in the direction favored by the more advantaged. And so we think that's because this is a forum that prizes listening to everybody. Everybody's voice is said to matter. And also may be that, you know, the more advantaged actually don't know a lot about the perspective of the less advantaged. The less advantaged may know a lot about the more advantaged from TV and other media, but the more advantaged may not have any idea what it's like to live without adequate health care or with terrible schools or as a victim of crime or et cetera, et cetera. And so they actually may learn a lot about perspectives that get them completely out of their filter bubbles. For whatever reason, we don't get those results. Now, why does that matter? Fundamentally, it matters, in my view, for this reason. We want, well, to use Habermas's famous phrase, the unforced or the forceless force of the better argument. The force should be the merits of the argument, as Mill said about the Congress of Opinions. If there's a pattern of group psychology that allows you to predict the result based upon the initial distribution of opinion, then obviously something else is going on, not the merits of the argument, but some other force of social conformity is engaged. And so therefore the conclusions are suspect. If there's a pattern. Now, it's only in a pattern. In any given case, you can't tell. But if you overwhelmingly got the patterns that the critics have offered, then you would know, which is why we try to collect thousands of cases. So I think that now, just because you don't have one of these patterns doesn't mean that it's ultimately the unforced force of the better argument, but it means that it could be. And then what you do is you look at whether there are coherent reasons for the conclusion. And you can quantitatively study that by doing regressions to see, you know, what is really producing the change. But you can also look at the transcripts of the discussions to see what they're saying in the small group about why they move one way rather than another. You can even do, you can not only excerpt the transcripts, but you can do automated text analysis and code the transcripts and actually look at every speech act. So we can look at this in all kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. And the picture that we get is that we are bringing to life thoughtful and engaged citizens who may not have thought about politics or public affairs in any sustained way before.
Mm-hmm. So does it depend on the case selection or the policy issue at hand? Because I'm thinking just off the top of my head that, you know, some of these issues you might not see a lot of polarization in the case of, say, transportation or finance, but have you done deliberative polls where it's on more divisive issues, say, that divides the American public, like, well, abortion or issues related to discrimination law or immigration or matters like that?
We did immigration just 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago in Houston.
Ah, yeah.
And believe me, that's a pretty intensely controversial topic.
Yeah.
And I can say, I don't think the Hobby School has released the results, but I can say that most of the significant changes, and there were a lot of significant changes, were in the direction of valuing the interests and the human rights of the undocumented immigrants.
But did you see polarization in the, I mean, so there could be movement.
I don't think they moved farther apart. I mean, they may not have moved as much close together as in some other projects, but, you know, you saw very significant movements of opinion. So just wait and see until the Houston results are properly released. But we did the condition of the Roma in Bulgaria, you know, where the prejudice against the Roma is very intense. And to our amazement, the percentage of people who were willing to support closing the Roma-only schools, because they were segregated schools, and busing the children into schools with everybody else, went up dramatically. And that played a role, we're told, in catalyzing the eventual movement to desegregate the schools in Bulgaria. And we also did the division between Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty intense. And we got we didn't have a transformative result, but we did get some very concrete, reasonable areas of cooperation between the two communities, and a dramatic rise in the sense in which each of the communities, the members in, thought the other was open to reason or trustworthy. Would go up by 16 points or so. So I thought that was really interesting, mm-hmm. particularly since when I looked at them at the beginning, I could see they weren't even interested in making eye contact with each other mm-hmm. in the small groups.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end, they were really communicating about their shared interest in having a schooling system that worked. Now, you might say schooling, well, that's not such a big issue. But in fact, that's how the two communities reproduce themselves over the generations. So the control over the schooling is really important
mm-hmm.
to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I wonder how much, I'm not sure how much you can figure this out, but how much of a kind of personal or contact effect there is in fostering that trust. Because, I mean, one of the interesting things about, I suppose, about in-person deliberative polls versus maybe on the internet, where it's maybe more impersonal, is precisely you can see that the person's right there in the room with you. You can chat it during breaks about your children or something like that. So there's a way in which the fellow participants are real people.
Well, let me say two things about that.
Yeah.
One is my former PhD student Mary Kim just wrote an article in the Journal of Communication, which is on our website also, about the contact effect and she dealt with the Roma Bulgaria stuff and the Aboriginals in Australia. And that definitely is part of the process. But I would say we just did this online deliberative poll, national one, on Brexit-related issues in the UK. And using Zoom, in fact, and we found that I think there's this, because you can see everybody in your small group of, let's say, a dozen people, you could see every one of them in the discussion the whole time. People are bonding very much like they would in the face-to-face. Virtually nobody drops out over the whole weekend. So I'm very optimistic about the online process with video.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So let's talk about the final part of your book, which, as you said, is about the sort of implementation of new institutional possibilities for deliberative democracy. And you run through a lot of different ones. I was curious about your view a bit about maybe what do you think could be, what sort of institutional reform do you think could have the most transformative effect or most significant effect?
Well, you know, there are lots of contexts. I mean, that's why I talk about entry points. Hmm. So it depends what the policy domain is that you're talking about. We're going to be doing a project at an unofficial entry point, which is the beginning of the presidential primary season.
Right. Yeah.
We're going to be doing a project in Texas in September. It's barely announced yet because we're dealing with the candidates and everybody else, but we're going to represent the whole country. It's called American in One Room. You can see it on our website now. We're sort of slowly bringing out the announcement of it, but we're doing it with the National Opinion Research Center, NORC, from the University of Chicago, and they are now recruiting the sample. And we will bring a national sample of 500 registered voters along with, there will be a control group of 800 who do not attend, but the 500 who do will be in Dallas deliberating about the key issues facing the country and also questioning presidential candidates. And I think the beginning of the primary season is an entry point where the deliberative views can have an impact, because right now, who the hell knows much about these 20-some candidates and their positions on the issues? But the people in our sample will. So that's one case. I thought that in a much more mundane area, the process that went in Texas very happily for every then regulated utility for planning its future needs with deliberative polling led Texas from being last in 1996 in the amount of wind power to being first by 2007 among all the 50 states. That should have continued, but the state deregulated all of its utilities. So this was part of the regulation of the utilities. So that disappeared with the deregulation. But I thought that was a really consequential idea and certainly had payoffs for climate change as all of the favored options, wind power, investments in conservation, which cut the need for electricity or demand side management, in other words, and natural gas, they're all relatively good for climate change compared to coal or oil or piping in fossil fuel created electricity from Mexico. So that would have been great if it continued. But I speculate about a lot of designs. One of them was the design that we were hoping to pilot in California, which we sort of piloted, but, you know, it was the idea that there ought to be some public interest propositions on the ballot for the initiative. Notice I'm not proposing to get rid of the initiative, but the problem is that the people who can pay for the signature collecting and then pay for the campaigns, they have a tremendous disproportionate power in setting the agenda for what the initiative is about. Mm-hmm. Why not empower the people to set some of the agenda? So there are a lot of designs in the last chapter. I couldn't even summarize it because a lot of it goes back to what I found extremely helpful in the study of deliberating microcosms in ancient Athens and their various roles, particularly in the 4th century Athenian institutions of the nomothetai, where they added a deliberative microcosm that had to pass something that passed the assembly was no longer a law, it was a proposal, and then it had to be passed, it had to be presented as a kind of a court case with an argument for and against, and only if a new random sample heard the arguments and deliberated and then approved it, did it become a law. Mm-hmm. And that was a kind of additional deliberative guarantee that it's thoughtful, as opposed to, you know, the orators could whip up fervor in the assembly and then mm-hmm. you might find terrible things happening, as happened when they ended up going to war against Sparta, which they lost. So I think that it's early days. The other thing that I'm doing that is sort of interesting that is alluded to in the book is we have the one of the ways in which my position has been criticized is that I'm relying too much on the microcosm and not the rest of the people. So I have a kind of philosophical debate going with my friend Christina Lafont, who's got a book coming out called Democracy Without Shortcuts, which you might want to interview her when it comes out with Oxford in the fall. A lot of it is an attack on deliberative polling. And so we have an exchange coming out, by the way. We have an exchange. A whole number of people are replying to my book, and I've just written a response. And the Good Society is going to have a symposium in their next issue, a rather large symposium, because there are 8 contributors, including Christina, who offer sustained critiques, and then I try to answer. So you should promote that, mm-hmm. this Good Society when it comes out, because it's got Jane Mansbridge and Mark Warren and Yves Saint-Omer and all kinds of interesting people who are, and Christina Lafont and Alain Lanmore, all kinds of interesting people who are reacting to the book and posing challenges to me, which I try to answer. So since there are 8 of them, it's going to be a good part of the issue. So in any case, so this debate continues, but Christina is very concerned about the people who are not in the sample, mm-hmm. And whether their democratic rights are undermined by letting people in the sample choose. And there is an issue there, which we engage at. We've been sparring for the last year about that. But one of the things that I'm also doing, which is a partial kind of response, is to say that we actually want everybody else to deliberate, of course. It's just normally they're not engaged or they think their voice doesn't matter, et cetera, et cetera. So we're actually working to implement a very preliminary version of what Bruce Ackerman and I together called Deliberation Day mm-hmm. in a book some years ago, mm-hmm. which is the idea of everybody deliberating. But the way we're proposing to do it is we've created, with a grant from the National Science Foundation, and this is alluded to in the book but not really explained enough, but we've created an automated moderator. And the automated moderator works if there's a pre-prepared agenda as you would have for a deliberative poll. You know, proposal one, arguments for and against, proposal two, arguments for and against, et cetera, et cetera. And then the automated moderator in a group of, let's say, a dozen, controls. We have special software where you see everybody on the screen at once, and it controls the queue, access to the microphone, and the amount of time anybody's able to talk. It makes sure the talking time is relatively equal. But it also solicits from the group a judgment whether the arguments for and against have been covered on that topic before it moves on to the next topic. Then at the end, it rather magically facilitates the group coming up with a statement of a key concern or question and allows everybody to participate in the revision of that statement until they think it's adequate. And it speaks with a voice. It actually speaks with Alice Hughes' voice, my associate director, she has a nice voice, and she's also a collaborator. So
lucky
I call
her,
it Alice, but I don't know if we're going to get to call it Alice but I call it Alice. Anyway, this automated moderator, suppose the automated Alice had 1,000 groups or 10,000 groups or 100,000 groups or a million groups. Eventually, there would be enough groups to really affect public opinion, because even an hour and a half discussion on a given issue is very significant. And so we're hoping to build this during the presidential campaign with opportunities to actually allow people to deliberate by recruiting via social media and employing algorithms to make sure that there are diverse people in your group. So the real magic of deliberation, I think, is moderated discussion with diverse others. If you're in a deliberative poll, you don't experience the full diversity of the random sample. You experience the diversity in your small group, primarily. So if you're exposed to diverse viewpoints deliberating on the merits, that's the treatment. And that treatment condition, if you think your voice matters, is important. So we're going to pilot, let's say, because I don't know how, we're still trying to raise money for this, but we're going to do some version of it. Even if I have to pay for it out of my own pocket, we're going to do some version of it. And the version is going to be, we can then post on YouTube the recorded statements of the small groups about what they think the campaigns need to respond to about each of the same five issues that we're doing this presidential project on. And that those five issues are immigration, healthcare, climate change, taxes, and foreign policy, which were selected in a previous NORC poll as the five big issues the public wanted to see discussed in the campaign. Mm-hmm. So we're going to pilot this, and we're talking to our friends in the UK and in Finland and in some other places about spreading this kind of apparatus in order to get more people deliberating. So my ultimate answer to – I have a philosophical answer to Christina Lafont in this dialogue coming out in The Good Society and in my book. But the ultimate answer is a practical one. That is, it's to agree with her that ultimately what we need is not a deliberative poll, but a deliberative society. But in the meantime, a deliberative poll is a good thing.
Yeah, this might be, this is quite interesting what you're saying. Some of these designs within the deliberation are quite interesting, because one of the other things that occurred to me when reading your book is this the very notion of the people's will, which is, as you know, kind of it's a vexed notion. One wonders about the use of this term, right? Because there's no such thing as the people. You can't see the people. It's not a visible it's an inference. And people, as you say, abuse the concept of the public will. And I suppose one worry about the use of the notion of the public will is something like, well, will it drown out the voices that are not expressed, right? If the group moves 15, 20 points in one direction and you say, there's the public will, well, what about the voices that aren't represented in that movement?
Well, look, in the small group, I mean, in the microcosm, they're represented. They participate much more equally.
Right.
And they're not subject to the bandwagon effects or the spiral of silence that you get in nature, you know, in an ordinary setting without, right. You know, there, if some voices are very loud, the rest of the people may not say anything at all. Elizabeth Noel Neumann charted that with the Nazis and their growth, you know, and the silence of the other people. But no, in the deliberative process properly constructed, everybody gets their say at length. And nobody even knows. You can draw inferences, but nobody really knows how the distribution of opinion. So I think a properly constructed deliberative process is going to treat minorities much better than some self-selected town meeting where the people who feel strongly show up and yell at everybody else.
Right. But the interpretation of the result, I suppose, I wonder about, you know, I mean, it would be one thing, I suppose, to interpret the results as, well, 80% of the people think this and then 20% think this. That would be one way to say it. Another way would be to say the people's will is identified with that 80%.
Well, we would always say these are the considered judgments in here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are the results and they speak for themselves. It's better than, I think, in some of these processes, what you have is a consensus statement that papers over the disagreements and, you know, you never even know what the reservations and other concerns are from the people who don't go along unless they file a minority report.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is a great place to end. So let me say, Jim, thanks so much for your time. You're doing wonderful work out there. And thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it very much.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.